I'm going to talk about some rather elementary things today, with the idea that I set up Ricky Wildman's talk. So I'm going to focus on the simplest granular system to which the kinetic theory will apply, and that's for identical, frictionless, spherical particles. And I'm going to be interested in phrasing boundary value problems where the boundaries consist of, flat surfaces to which spherical particles have been glued, have been adhered. I'll remind you quickly of the elements of the kinetic theory that you're all probably familiar with now. We're dealing with particle velocities. We can, with suitable averaging that I won't say anything about here, we can define a mean velocity. Once we have a mean velocity, which varies with position and time in the flow, we can define a velocity fluctuation. And then the simplest measure of the strength of that velocity fluctuation, or the simplest measure of the velocity fluctuations is simply the strength. Although I'll mention that there is a tensor measure that we can also use, that is the tensor product of C with itself. And in theories that involve more dissipation, we regard that measure as being necessary in addition to this isotropic measure of the velocity fluctuations. But in any case, as long as there's not too much energy dissipated in collisions, and I'll try to make that more precise in just a moment, this is the only additional field, the only field in addition to the mean velocity and the volume fraction, or alternatively the mass per unit volume of the material that we need follow. And we have balance equations of the usual form for mass and linear momentum. The new balance equation for this additional field has a familiar form from our encounters with heat conduction in Newtonian fluids, for example. There's an internal energy term, which is simply kinetic energy in this case. There's no interparticle potential to contribute an internal energy apart from the kinetic energy. There's a flux of fluctuation energy, and there's a production of fluctuation energy that is associated with particles moving with the mean being driven into collisions with one another. And then there's a non-classical term here. There's a term that has no counterpart in kinetic theory for molecular species, where the collisions are assumed to be elastic, and this is the rate of collisional dissipation. And this changes things dramatically. It permits this equation, as we'll see in a moment, it permits this equation to have steady solutions for homogeneous steady situations. So when this term is absent, and when this term is absent, there's a possible balance between these two terms, and there's no counterpart for that in the molecular kinetic theory. Molecular kinetic theory, in the absence of this term, for example, if you have a homogeneous flow, so this term is absent, you're going to get a constant increase in temperature. The constitutive relations for frictionless, nearly elastic spheres, in fact, can be read off almost entirely from the book on kinetic theory by Chapman and Cowling. That is, the constitutive equations for the stress and the constitutive equations for the heat flux for frictionless, nearly elastic spheres, that is, when the dissipation is small, is the same as for elastic spheres. The contribution of the dissipation to the stress and to the energy flux is of the same order as terms that have been ignored in deriving the constitutive relations. So I say you can get these from Chapman and Cowling. Chapman and Cowling use a rather crude radial distribution function, and here's up to a factor of nu. This is a radial distribution function of Carnahan and Starling. Nu is the volume fraction of the solid particles. So here I write rho s times nu. Rho s is meant to be the density of the material that comprises the particles. So that this product I'm later going to just write as rho. But I wanted to show you explicitly where the volume fraction of particles appear in the theory. And so here's the dilute pressure, and here's the dense gas correction to the pressure. And you see that the volume fraction dependence of the viscosity and the volume fraction dependence of the of the heat flux involve both G and nu. Okay, and then finally, the non-classical part, that this rate of collisional dissipation involves the coefficient of restitution, and it simply is a statement that particles colliding lose energy, and there's a frequency of collision that's involved there in that product. So we get a rate of collisional dissipation. Now, in fact, I'm going to. So these are the constitutive equations that I'll use somewhat later in phrasing and setting up a boundary value problem. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to focus attention on a simpler theory. And this is a theory that works for what I call dense flows. So I have to be a little bit careful, because we've been talking about dense flows down inclines, and those have a character that is different from the dense flows that I want to talk about. So I want to talk about dense flows in which the particles truly interact with binary collisions. And the reason I want to do that is because I can get analytical solutions to the boundary value problems that I phrase. Okay, so the way I'm going to go about that is I'm going to, in the constitutive relations, I'm going to ignore terms that are 1 over g. That is, for a value of nu of about 0.5, I think g turns out to be 12. So in the equations for j and m, I'm going to ignore these terms and retain these terms, which persist in this dense limit. And in the pressure, I'm going to just toss out the kinetic contribution, the perfect gas contribution, and retain only the dense gas correction. And that leads to a rather simple set of equations. So here's the dense limit. So I'm looking at flows, in my view, somewhere between 40% and 55% concentration. I don't want to push them too far beyond that. But we can simulate these flows. They exist in nature, and in any case, this is an instructive example to see how we can solve problems in the kinetic theory. So as I said, the pressure has this very simple form, and one advantage here is we can write this combination of volume fraction dependence and a factor of t to the 1/2 purely in terms of the pressure and the temperature. And that's useful because there are many flows in which you know something about the pressure. I'm going to be looking at the flows in which the pressure is constant. But flows down inclines, you know how the pressure varies with depth. And then the second point to notice is in this dense limit, now J is just a number and M is just a number, in this dense limit, this factor rho, 4 rho g t to the 1/2 appears in all of the transport coefficients. So in every one of the transport coefficients, I can eliminate the dependence on the volume fraction in favor of the dependence on the pressure and temperature. So that's going to give me a very simple set of equations. So I'm going to first focus on this constitutive theory. I'm going to talk next about boundary conditions, how we phrase boundary conditions, how we derive boundary conditions, and then I'll talk about the solution of the boundary value problem. Oh, but first I want to say something about simple shear, I guess. Just as a way to indicate to you how the temperature is set by the flow, if you like, and also to explain why I'm so careful about talking about small dissipation. So what I mean by simple shear is the temperature is homogeneous, is a constant, and the volume fraction is constant, and the shear rate is, or the velocity is linear, so that the shear rate is uniform across the flow. And for this, in this dense limit, and we might as well talk about this, it's just a little simpler, here's the expression for the shear stress. I haven't written anything, I haven't eliminated the volume fraction dependence. And here's the expression for the rate of collisional dissipation, and here's the pressure. And in this case, in this homogeneous steady case, here is this balance. Here is the balance between the rate of working of the shear stress and the rate of collisional dissipation. And if you solve by substituting for S and substituting for gamma, you get an explicit expression for the temperature as a function of the rate of shear, and the temperature is quadratic in the rate of shear. Okay, so there's a determination. There's an example of how the energy equation determines the strength of the velocity fluctuation in a very simple flow. And also, I mean, an alternative to this is that you could say that the shear rate, appropriately normalized, made dimensionless by the diameter and the square root of the temperature, is proportional to 1 minus E. So do we have some chalk? No, I don't. That's okay. So the point is, another way to look at this is as an expression that says, oh good, okay. So what I'm saying here is that, alternatively, we can write this expression as, let's say, proportional to 1 minus E. So this is the shear rate. I mean, this is essentially a velocity gradient here. So terms in the derivation of the constitutive equation, terms like this are assumed to be small. Okay. So if we want to have consistency with that assumption in this, let's say, most fundamental or simplest of shearing flows, we've got to assume, this goes in 1/2. We've got to assume that this quantity is small, you know, the same order as the gradients or the normalized gradients that we've been ignoring in the derivation of the constitutive relation. So that's why I'm focused on nearly elastic particles for this simple theory. In our view, when the elasticity becomes greater, we have to take into account the full second moment of the velocity fluctuations. And that's possible to do. Okay. So now I want to say something about the derivation of boundary conditions. And the derivation of boundary conditions goes pretty much the way the derivation of the constitutive relations go. That is, we focus attention on a flow particle, which is this large white particle, interacting with the boundary particles, which are these spheres that have been glued to a flat surface. And we characterize what we call the bumpiness of the boundary by how deeply, on average, a particle of the flow can penetrate between the boundary particles. Because we have frictionless spheres, we have to have geometric irregularities on the boundaries in order to be able to couple in terms of a tangential transfer of momentum. Flat boundaries wouldn't do it for us. So we've got to have a geometric feature. And this angle theta characterizes the bumpiness, we say, of the boundary. And we can make a boundary, let's say, more bumpy in two ways. We can separate the particles that we've glued to the boundary, so a flow particle can penetrate more deeply. Or we can make the boundary particles larger, so that a flow particle will penetrate more deeply. And both of these ways of adjusting the geometry of the boundary are captured in this angle theta. Okay, so that's how we characterize the geometry of the boundary, and that's important because the way we derive the typical boundary conditions for tangential momentum or energy is we look at a collision between a flow particle and a wall particle, and look at either the momentum exchange in that collision or the energy exchange in that collision. And the thing about the geometry of the boundary is that the presence of neighbors provides a shadowing, so that not all collisions are possible. And that's the way the bumpiness of the boundary enters into the calculation of the momentum transfer or energy transfer. So the way we calculate boundary conditions is we characterize the exchange of momentum or energy in a single collision, and then we do simple averaging with the same velocity distribution that we used in the flow. So we're not taking into account any feedback about the presence of the boundary on the velocity distribution in the flow. Okay, so that's a limitation. But in any case, for the tangential momentum balance, we get a I should also say at the outset that in doing this, we permit the flow to have an average velocity relative to the boundary. That is, our experience in the driven flows that we've been looking at between parallel bumpy boundaries is that the material inevitably slips on average with respect to the boundary. So that the slip velocity is an important element in the transfer of momentum and energy from the boundary into the flow.
Slip velocity is scaling some central wave in some sense.
I would say not in a simple way. That is, we're going to get homogeneous. We're going to get homogeneous distributions of just about everything. The slip velocity is going to be determined as in the course of solving the boundary value problem, or it's going to be. I wouldn't say that. No, I don't think that's so. That is the fact that the incline flows, for example, the deep incline flows aren't slipping, is due to the rugged nature of the boundary. Okay, I think you can get slip if you have a relatively simple hexagonal boundary. And it's Gary here. Gary Gress mentioned that he would see slip in his deep flows with the appropriate smooth or not very bumpy boundary. Okay, so if we look at the balance of tangential momentum due to collisions between flow particles and wall particles, we get a relationship between the shear stress normalized by the pressure and the slip velocity normalized by the square root of the granular temperature, and it involves a slip coefficient F that we can write as an explicit function of the bumpiness. This just comes from the geometry. So we've got a boundary condition, if you like, that will determine the slip velocity in terms of the stress ratio. That's fine. And then we need a boundary condition on the energy. And the boundary condition on the energy comes about by, I say, looking at the balance of energy, the transfer of energy in a collision between the particles, assuming that there is some average slip velocity. And the statement, I'll say that in words, so what that says is that the working of the shear stress through the slip velocity can either be dissipated in collisions with the boundary. Here's a coefficient of restitution of a collision between a flow particle and a wall particle, which could be different from the coefficient of restitution in collisions between flow particles and flow particles. In any case, this working is either dissipated or created or turned into fluctuations. I mean, it's kind of easy to see. So the idea is that we've got a flow that's moving on average past a bumpy boundary, and the fact that it's moving on average past a bumpy boundary means that the particles are being driven into collisions with the bumps on the boundary, and that's scattering, that's creating fluctuations. Or if the boundary particles are rather dissipated, it's dampening, it's killing those fluctuations. So the idea is that we can design boundaries by suitable adjustment of the geometry, and you have less freedom with the coefficient of restitution, to either provide fluctuation energy to the flow, that is to be sources of heat, or to dissipate fluctuation energies. This could be negative, and the boundary can serve as a sink of fluctuation energy. Okay, and there's a coefficient that appears in here too that has to do with the bumpiness in the dissipation, and that's characterized. And I guess I give as an example here, if you have a hexagonal close back boundary, then theta is about pi over 6. Okay, so those are the boundary conditions. So we've got constitutive relations, we've got balance laws, we've got boundary conditions. So now phrase a boundary value problem. And the boundary value problem I'm going to phrase in the simplest possible one I can think of. So let's imagine the boundaries are identical. I'm operating between parallel bumpy boundaries, absence of gravity. I'm not going to take gravity into account here. So it makes sense to take into account the symmetry of the problem. So I'll set my axis up on the center line and just work, let's say, with the top half of the flow. And at the center line, I know that the temperature gradient is zero by symmetry, or equivalently, the heat flux is zero, and that the velocity is zero. So I've got boundary conditions on the center line. And I have boundary conditions at the upper boundary corresponding to the balance of tangential momentum and the balance of energy. So in this simple problem, I imagine I know P, S, and U. And what I want to predict, for example, is H and all of the fields of volume fraction across the flow, the fields of of fluctuation energy across the flow, that is granular temperature, and the fields of mean velocity across the flow. And I just want to show you, give you an indication that of how it goes about. So first, let's see. So I suppose that P, S, and U are known. Let's see. I know that P is a constant. I'm going to come back to this relation. I'm going to come back to this relation later, once I've determined what the granular temperature is, and then with the known value of P and the known variation of the granular temperature across the flow, I'm going to use this equation to determine how the volume fraction varies across the flow. So that's an algebraic equation. Now, incidentally, I mean, this flow is going to be inhomogeneous because the way that the particles are interacting with each other in the interior is different from the way that the particles are interacting with the boundary. Okay, so that the transfer of momentum and transfer of energy is going to be different in the interior of the flow and at the boundary, and that's going to give rise to inhomogeneities across the flow. I'm assuming that nothing varies in this direction and everything is steady. So that's what I mean by fully developed. No variation in X, all the variation is with Y. Okay, so I've got constant pressure because there's no gravity. I've got constant shear stress. Nothing's happening in the X direction. This provides me with the equation that I later invert in order to determine the mean velocity once this measure of the granular temperature is determined. And the kind of the miracle here in the context of this theory is that the equation that determines the square root of the temperature, which is essentially proportional to the RMS value of the velocity fluctuations, is a linear equation. And this linear equation involves a term that is essentially the analog of heat conduction, and a term that contains two pieces, that contains the dissipation. So here's a term contributed by gamma, if you like. And here is a term that's contributed by S U prime. So this is the rate of production, if you like, of velocity fluctuations, and this is related to the rate of dissipation of velocity fluctuations. And this quantity K can be positive or negative, depending upon whether the dissipations are the rate of collisional dissipation at a point is dominating the rate of production, or vice versa. But in any case, this equation is simple to solve, as is this equation, once the W has been determined. And here are the solutions. So this problem is dead easy. Here's the expression for the square root of the temperature. W0 is the value of the temperature on the center line. The equation for U is parameterized in terms of that, but it's an easy integral. So that in this instance, the profiles, the profile temperature looks something like this, and that this steady solution is possible only if there's a production of energy at the boundary. So that in order to get steady, fully developed solutions, in some sense, the flow in the inside and the boundaries have to be matched, and we'll come to that in a moment. On the other hand, if the internal production is dominating the dissipation, then the solution involves an energy which is a maximum at the boundary. I'm sorry. Let's see. I mean, which is the maximum in the interior. And this requires that the boundary be a dissipated boundary in order to have a steady, fully developed solution of this form.
Is the slip velocity coming yet?
Not yet. No. I'll get to that. Yes.
Just asking for your further. Could you just comment on the linearity? Does that reflect the assumptions in constitutive words with the original linearities?
Well, there are a couple. For one thing, that energy equation is uncoupled from everything else. So not only is it linear, but it's uncoupled by virtue of my replacing the volume fraction dependence by the dependence on P and T. And then in this problem, P is constant. So P essentially factors out of that equation. Why is it linear in the, when phrased in terms of the square root of T? I mean, I don't know.
Because G is large.
G is large.
That's the reason it's linear. Because you're neglecting all terms that are 1 over G.
Yes, but how do you see that that makes it linear? I mean, it's linear in T to the 1/2.
Isn't that the dimension of the monotone? Except T to the 1/2 has to be related to the same thing.
There's your explanation. Apply to Qumran. But I mean, it wasn't clear to me at the outset that was going to be a linear equation. I think, in fact, Savage and I were doing this. We didn't see beforehand. It was kind of a miracle as far as we were concerned. Now I'm talking about boundary conditions. So this boundary condition is the energy boundary condition now, written in terms of the constitutive equations and this quantity W equal to the square root of T. And so this is the typical kind of boundary condition we get at a bumpy boundary. It relates the derivative of the strength of the velocity fluctuations to the strength itself, and the coefficient is similar to the coefficient K that we saw on the interior of the flow. It has to do with whether the boundary is, whether the production of fluctuations by the boundary is greater than the dissipation of fluctuations. And this can go either in either way. And the solutions for a dissipative interior require that this be positive. The solutions for a productive interior require that this be negative. And for the dissipative interior, we apply this boundary condition to the form of W that we obtain, that the hyperbolic cosines, and we generate an equation for the determination of H. So this boundary condition serves to determine the thickness of the flow that is consistent with the pressure that we're applying to the top boundary. So this is, if you like, this is an additional condition that we have to, or that the flow will adjust itself to in order to be steady and fully developed. On the other hand, if the flow is productive in the interior, then we get a different equation for the determination of H. The point is that K, if we know S and P and the coefficient of restitution, then quantity K is determined and B is determined. And so everything in this equation except for H is known. Okay, so that takes care of the determinant of H. And now we talk about the slip condition. So the slip boundary condition at the upper boundary, this is the slip velocity, the velocity of the boundary less the value of the interior flow at the value or at the boundary. And this is given in terms of quantities that are known now that we know the solution for W1. So the knowledge of W1 then allows us to determine really what the scale of the internal of the temperature is, depending upon whether we're having a dissipative interior or a productive interior. So the solution's finished, or the solution's finished up to the determination of the volume fraction profile, which comes from that algebraic relationship between the pressure, the volume fraction, and the temperature. Okay, so this was just a little stroll through the simplest boundary value problem that we can solve for these bumpy frictionless boundaries. And now I just want to say that in general, we don't have boundary value problems that are quite that simple. We typically have problems where gravity is present, and there are dilute regions in the flow, is rather more in addition to rather more dense regions. So we have a full range of volume fractions across the flow. Typically, our boundaries are not identical. So here is a boundary that is schematically more bumpy. The top boundary is more bumpy than the bottom boundary, so that the exchange of momentum and energy at the two boundaries is going to be different. The boundary conditions will be different. And typically, the way that a real experimental situation is treated is that we know the total volume of particles that we put in the cell. We typically know the way we load the top surface. So that in annular shear cells, for example, in annular shear cells, the weight of the upper surface of the cell is known. And when you start the experiment, that top cell presses on the particles. And then as the annular shear cell moves, it agitates the particles. And the agitation of the particles then is exchanging momentum with the top surface, and it expands in response to the collisions with the flow particles. So H is something that we want to determine as part of the solution of the problem. So we typically know the volume, the weight, or if you like, the pressure applied over a unit area of the top surface, and we know how the velocity of the upper surface. And these are the quantities we want to predict. And now I just want to show you the system. Well, so the boundary conditions we have, we know the pressure. I call that capital P. Now the pressure is going to vary through the depth of the flow because gravity is present. We know we have expressions for the slip velocity in terms of the bumpiness of the upper surface and lower surface. Here the situation is not quite so simple as it was in the analytical problem that I showed you, because although the shear stress is constant through the flow, because we're still fully developed, everything is only varying in this direction, the pressure is going to be varying. And we've got boundary conditions on the energy at the upper and lower boundary, and of course, as I say, the pressure at the upper and lower boundary is not going to be the same, and the bumpiness of the boundary is different. So that this is a more complicated problem. And I'll just write down the first order system that we solve in order to deal with this boundary value problem. And everything on this slide ought to be familiar to you. This is just a statement that the shear stress doesn't vary with y. And we include that in the system of equations because our solver then will automatically give us the value of s. Incidentally, we typically solve these problems in MATLAB. And it's an easy exercise for MATLAB. So here I'm looking at I still have the dense constitutive theory here, although I could do this for the more general constitutive theory. Well, here I'm sorry. In this here, M and J are the full functions of G that I showed you earlier. So we have the possibility of going from dilute to dense in this situation. And here's the balance of vertical momentum. Here's the constitutive relation for the energy flux. Here's the energy balance. Here's the constitutive relation for the shear stress. All these phrased as first order equations. And typically, we'll rewrite this equation as an equation for the variation in volume fraction, and then use our knowledge of the total volume of materials in the cell in a way that introduces another equation and introduces two additional boundary conditions. So we can solve for everything at the same time in the context of a solver for a first order system. And I'll just point out that we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 equations, and there were 5 boundary conditions on the previous slide, and there are 2 boundary conditions here, so there's 7. So there are 7 boundary conditions and 6 equations, and the fact that we have more boundary conditions than equations allows us to solve for the thickness as part of the solution of the equations. Okay, so what have I said? We can phrase boundary value problems in the context of kinetic theories. We can find easy analytical solutions in the limit of dense flows, and we can determine numerical simulations in the more complicated, or numerical solutions in the more complicated situations. Thank you.
Suppose that I ask about the stability of this, if it gets thrown away all the time part.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not clear that any of these flows that I've talked about are stable. That's another analysis.
Right. So you put a half a sine wave in the density across this thing, so you have a bulge in the density in the middle, for instance, and my sort of naive thought would be that would be unstable because
if there's gravity?
Well, even without gravity, because your collision rate would increase, your dissipation would increase in the middle. The standard clustering issue might come up if you put a bulge in density somewhere and ask whether that bulge would decay.
Yeah, so you're, let's see. So you're saying that the flows, you're saying the flows that have the greater density in the middle.
Or somewhere, right? I mean, it doesn't mean it has to be the middle, but you just put something, put an inhomogeneity in the density.
But, you know, but the inhomogeneities exist for a reason. And that's because the interaction with the boundary is different than the interactions in the interior.
No, but I'm saying, but now perturbed, that's
the... Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I mean, people have perturbed... are people perturbed inhomogeneous shear flows?
Homogeneous
or inhomogeneous? They've looked at the homogeneous. So they've looked at the instabilities, possible instabilities of homogeneous shear flows. I don't know that there's anybody that's looked at the...
And so the answer is that those instabilities are they're not instabilities. Is that right? Is that the answer?
Well, no. The homogeneous flows are often or inevitably
unstable,
depending on the size of the system.
Depends on the size of the system. It depends on coefficients of distribution. Okay. Basically, the size of the system puts a lower cutoff on the wavelengths that are possible, basically. And these are unstable, like very long wavelengths. In the gradient direction as well as in the quantity direction.
But I should say that in terms of that we test these predictions with numerical simulations. And the numerical simulations indicate that the predictions are excellent. However, though, you know, we those aren't huge cells, and so my suspicion is you make the cells large enough, and you're going to begin to see types of instabilities. On the other hand, the sizes of simulations we're doing are kind of realistic for the experimental devices that are in use. So the size sometimes will suppress instabilities that might occur in larger systems.
The other thing that suppresses is that the base state is a shear state. So getting an eigenvalue problem, you have a linearly varying velocity. The varying eigenvalue problem itself is hard. We do that by rotating with the wave vector. And when you do that, you find that at short times it's unstable, at long times it's stable. So if you do just a short time analysis, you can often get the wrong result.
Well, that's a type of instability. I mean, that's a linear instability that...
It stabilizes at long time.
That's right, yeah. So the
shear actually stabilizes that dissipative instability.
Just make a comment. We actually did some MD simulations for the similar volume fractions you're looking at. We see pretty similar, high volume fractions in the middle, like away from the shear.
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as the cell is not so dense, This analysis is going to, or the dense analysis gives you the features that you would observe.
I was wondering, you had the angle theta in your model. I was wondering, if I think of limit of small theta, does it correspond to like a smooth surface or something like that?
Yeah.
So you had somewhere in your F, you had one of the
data squared,
I remember. So
yeah, so I mean, the analysis kind of falls apart in that limit because you can't couple tangentially to that smooth surface.
So kind of
So if you want to deal with that, then you got to put some... So I haven't said anything about friction, okay? Now, the reality is you can't escape it. And so we can modify these boundary conditions by incorporating friction, and we can modify the constitutive relations in the interior by including friction. Now, the way we include friction in the interior is very simple. We only include it in the energetics. And so we derive an effective coefficient of restitution that's due to the fact that you're losing energy to internal degrees of freedom and to the working of friction. Okay, so we can incorporate small amounts of friction, I would say. The theory that we're dealing with, you can't push beyond, let's say, maybe 0.15 or something like that. Larger amounts of friction create larger amounts of dissipation, and they put you in the bad situation again of having to look at a nonlinear constitutive relation.
No, it's just the problem of knowing what is the limit of the solution here. Because
I mean, how far can you push it in terms of coefficient restitution, or
when you do it for an experiment, for instance? How is it to get such conditions, to get this approximation
to an
experimental context? Yeah, but I mean, so Michel Louge, for example, measures the coefficients of restitution and the coefficients of friction of the particles that we employ in the physical experiments. So we're, so So we're certain in that regard that we are dealing with materials and situations that are encompassed by the theory. So, I mean, I think that's an important point, is that, so Michelle and I do, Michelle does physical experiments and simulations, I do some theory, or we get mixed up in all of it. But the key in connecting everything is his measurements of the particle collision properties, because that makes the simulation realistic, and then we can compare, and we compare the physical experiment to the simulation and theory to, you know, we go all around. But you got to have a good collision operator, and you got to be able to measure the parameters in the collision operator.
For instance, what is the ratio between the gradient of speed and the temperature?
I don't know. Pardon me? Yeah, I mean, I would say it's small, but it's not as small as you'd like it to be. You know, it might be 0.75, or, you know, it's. However, this theory is I think perhaps an example of a theory that might be better than its derivation. You know, you can push it. Okay, so we try to push it, and then we try to see how it fails. I mean, that's the interesting thing. But it sometimes surprises us how far we can push it. No, velocity, the slip condition was the balance of tangential momentum, and the energy condition was the balance of total energy.
I could place it the other way, right? That the energy boundary condition gives me the dynamics, and then I make the tangential velocity whatever it has to be to satisfy the slip condition.
You mean to satisfy the balance of tangential momentum? Yeah, well, I mean, they're independent calculations. Okay. Yeah. Except the slip velocity is enters into the total energy condition.